And what's it like to come face to face with a great white shark? Well, Brian Scarry is one person who knows. As a National Geographic photographer, he spent more than 10,000 hours just a few feet from the animals. In 2017, he published a book of his pictures, aptly titled Shark. I spoke with him then about how, unlike most wildlife photographers, he's usually within touching distance of his subjects.
You know, I don't know that most people think about that, but as an underwater photographer, you know, I don't have the luxury that my terrestrial counterparts do, where you can use a 600 millimeter lens or maybe sit in a camouflage blind for a month waiting for some elusive animal. I have to get into the ocean. I'm limited by the air supply on my back and got to get real close.
How close?
Right on the lens, practically. You know, to get great pictures, particularly of animals like sharks, you need to be close. You know, the ocean acts as a giant filter. It refracts light, it reflects light, it scatters light. And I usually need to add a little light to bring back color and detail. So, you know, 3 feet is ideal between your camera and the subject, but sometimes even closer.
Well, and I ask that because you have to get close to animals that would terrify most people. There's a section in your book written by Eric Vance, and it's about great whites. And I want to read a little bit about it.
Sure.
He says that meeting one in the wild is nothing like you'd expect. At first glance, it's portly, bordering on fat like an overstuffed sausage. From the side, one of the world's greatest predators is little more than a slack-jawed buffoon. It's only when it turns to face you that you understand why it's the most feared animal on Earth.
Yeah.
Is that what it was like for you?
Well, that's a very interesting description. I spent time in the field with Eric, and I was sort of amused at that description. But at times, yeah, I think, you know, with the great white, that it is accurate. But he's absolutely right that when you're sort of nose to nose with an animal like this, or you see it sort of approaching you from that head-on view, you know, you have this primal sort of reaction, I think.
So how do you handle that? Are you always in a cage?
I'm only in a cage with great whites. At least that's my sort of protocol. There are people who do choose to swim with great whites without a cage, but so far I haven't seen that as a really good thing to do. But, but you know, it's really the only species. Everything else, makos, blue sharks, tiger sharks, whatever, I'm not in a cage. And that's because, number one, for photography, it's better to sort of be out there, you know, having more mobility and being able to move and get close. But it's also a testament to the animals that, you know, despite popular belief, they're really not nearly as bad as they've been portrayed.
Is there a time that you've been down there and you've felt in danger?
Well, there was a moment on an expedition. I did a five-week expedition to a place called the Southern Line Islands, one of the most remote coral reef systems in the world in the central South Pacific. Also, like going back in time. So these coral reefs were probably like the rest of the world was hundreds of years ago, and they're very predator heavy, lots of sharks. I was diving one night at Millennium Atoll at sunset, and my assistant and I ended up being sort of surrounded by probably in excess of 60 gray reef sharks.
Wow.
And gray reef sharks are beautiful animals, but they can have a bit of an attitude, and they were, you know, aggressive. They sort of were coming in hot, as I say. And normally, if an animal does that, you can sort of bounce it with your camera a little bit, and they usually are deterred. But
you hit the shark with your camera.
Yeah, they'll come in and sort of bounce their nose off it. Mm-hmm. And if you push back a little bit, they usually deter. But in this case, they weren't doing that. The lead shark was doing like a 360 coming back in, and behind that was 5, and behind that was another 10. And, you know, it wasn't a great situation.
So there's an alpha like in a pack of dogs?
It almost seemed that way. Mm-hmm. I don't know the science behind that, but that's how they were sort of behaving, kind of like I envision a wolf pack. But again, that is totally anomalous. That's not my usual experience. That, you know, one experience versus countless that were very benign and good.
When you're taking pictures underwater, what's it like to get perspective right? Because you're working in this very foreign backdrop where you probably don't have a lot of ways to reference size and scale, and yet that's a really important part of taking pictures of a shark.
That is so good, and rarely, I don't know, ever have I been asked that, but it's true. And I do talk about that in the book as well, that, you know, to the degree that I can do it, I want to show sharks within their world, within their habitat, whether it's a coral reef reef or a temperate zone or whatever it might be, a mangrove nursery where baby sharks might live. But I do think that context is very important to human understanding of these animals, to see them as something more than just this, you know, villainous shape up in the blue void. Sometimes it means having a person in the picture to give scale or a shark cage or some reference point that we can process in our brains and say, all right, that shark is about this big, and, you know, but it's an important part of the equation, and it helps frame the context of these animals and their world.
And conservation is actually a pretty big part of your book, especially near the end, and it's a little disturbing, actually, because you've taken images of people, I assume they're poachers of some kind, or hunters that are cutting the fins off of sharks, and I assume the bodies are also just sort of left on the beach to rot. The stat that you use is that industrial fishing is responsible for most of the 100 million shark deaths every year. 100 million. I mean, how is that even possible?
Yeah, it's hard to fathom, really, but it's not only possible, but it's been going on for a long time. Most researchers that I've talked to about this say that it could be a conservative number, that the number could be as high as 170 or 200 million, largely for their fins.
Yeah. Are we talking about, you know, soup in China or something?
That's exactly what we're talking about. Yeah, the shark fin soup trade. But they're also being harvested in many cases for low-cost sources of ingredients for cosmetics and many different products out there. But the fin trade is the biggest offender, according to everything that I know. Mm-hmm. And to your point about poaching, in many cases, no, it's completely legal what these folks are doing. And, you know, countries sanction it. So a big part of my work is been to sort of show these animals as something far more than villains, as demons, as they've often been portrayed, to show that they're complex, that they have a personality, and that they are important to the health of the ocean. You know, if we can get to a point where we can see their magnificence, maybe we can move that dial away from killing them.
You write that the population of the oceanic white-tip shark, I had never even heard of that animal before, is down to 1% of its historic population. How endangered is that species, and is that the most endangered species?
First part of your question, it's extremely endangered. It's on the brink of extinction. This is an animal, the oceanic white-tip shark, which is a pelagic animal, lives out in the blue water, the deep water of the ocean, an animal that has to be especially efficient at hunting and good at what they do. As recently as the 1970s, this is an animal that was listed by scientific literature as the most abundant large animal on planet Earth, large meaning anything more than 100 pounds. So it went from the 1970s being the most abundant large animal on planet Earth to being on the verge of extinction today, mostly hunted for their fins, not unlike the passenger pigeon or what we did to the American bison, almost wiping that out. So it is critically endangered. It is on the verge. And that's a substantial loss in just a few decades. Is it the most endangered? I don't know the answer to that. I certainly think that there are probably others in that same category, but it is without question one of the most endangered, and I think that story speaks volumes.
It's fascinating because these animals have been on Earth for 450 million years.
Right.
They've survived five mass extinctions on this planet. And yet, generally speaking, now they're having trouble.
Yeah, that's right. And that's part of the story, you know, that they have been around so long. They've remained unchanged for millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, because they have evolved to be perfect for the environment in which they live. But yet these anthropogenic stresses that are occurring today, obviously the overfishing and the hunting, but habitat loss and pollution and plastics and all the other things that are happening in the ocean. The ocean's dying a death of 1,000 cuts, and it's affecting sharks, but everything else.
But can you understand why people are afraid of them and why it might be hard to drum up sympathy for sharks? Because, you know, as we're children, we're taught, one of the first things we're taught is that they can bite through license plates and cans of paint, and you go to the beach, and when you're a kid, that's the first thing you're afraid of when you step into the water.
Well, absolutely. And this is the premise from which I started, knowing that, you know, I too, as a child, was taught those things and believed those things. But I've come to see a very different view of these animals. And I do think that we can respect predators in the ocean just like we do grizzly bears or tigers, lions, you know, all these wolves, whatever. We understand their magnificence. And I think what's been lost to a large extent with sharks is that complexity. We don't necessarily see them as a majestic creature the way we do a pack of wolves in Yellowstone, you know. But I think photography can serve that purpose, and it can help people to understand that a shark is not a shark is not a shark, that each species is different. They have unique biologies. They have unique morphologies. And if we can see them as something incredible, you know, that a mako shark can swim 60 miles an hour and is endothermic, it can generate heat in its body, and that a great white, the great whites off Cape Cod, live to 70 years old, and they have these enigmatic patterns that we don't fully understand yet. Where do they go? Where do they, what wisdom might they possess? And then again, you know, making that connection to a healthy ocean, our healthy lives to humans, I think that's all part of the equation.
That was National Geographic wildlife photographer Brian Scarry. I spoke with him in 2017. We'll have pictures from the book at hereandnow.org. And we went looking for other shark news, and what do you know? We found some. It's taken 30 years, but University of Rhode Island shark researcher Bradley Weatherby has finally named the shark species he discovered in the 1990s. The deep sea creature has been dubbed Layla's lantern shark. The bioluminescent shark is 3 feet long. It lives 1,000 feet below sea level, has a prominent snout that distinguishes it from other lantern sharks. He named the shark after his daughter, Layla, who is presumably not luminescent, though full of light in other ways, I'm sure.